Hello and welcome to the Transforming Society podcast from Bristol University Press. My name's George Miller, and I'm the editor of a new paperback series that BUP launched this spring. Over the next few years, What Is It For? Will explore the purpose of a range of institutions, beliefs, ideologies, and other phenomena that make up the contemporary world, from AI to zoos, nuclear weapons to free speech. Inherent in the series' concept is the idea that the answer to the question will probably be complex and up for debate, but that it's worth asking in order to think about how the future could be better. The series launched with three titles: War, Cybersecurity, and Philanthropy. And this is my final conversation with Jack MacDonald, who's a senior lecturer in the Department of War Studies, King's College London, and author of What Is War For? Watching the war in Ukraine unfold over the past year or so, the role of technology has been abundantly clear, from the high-end weapons systems that Ukraine has requested from the West, to repurposed civilian technology, captured enemy technology, the increasing prominence of drones, and not least the humble smartphone, whose ability to record, transmit, and geolocate is changing the way war is experienced for those caught up in it and those watching from afar. When I spoke to Jack, I began by asking how the theme of technology fitted into his wider exploration of what war is for.
I see technology as a really interesting dimension to war, in part because there's almost two approaches to it. Like, if you look at technology in military history, you can see the influence of, say, specific weapons or weapon systems on the conduct of war. But you can also see the development of new civilian technologies or infrastructures as having huge influences and impacts on the conduct of war. The development of railway networks, for example, or telegraph communications networks, new engines, things like that. The thing that I find most interesting about technology as it relates to war is the relationship between these kind of like new ways in which human beings develop to kill each other, but how they intersect with kind of like longer term kind of like changes in civilian infrastructure, which really set the background for human life and activity. And so when we talk about new technology in war, we're often drawn to things like drones or like lethal autonomous weapon systems, things like that. But one of the things I tried to kind of do in the book is to give people and readers an understanding of perhaps there's like longer term shifts that are going on. And I think this is kind of how I tried to explain my choice to kind of like feature sort of like 20th century, 21st century more cohesively, is to say that there are actually some very big changes that happen in human society which are closely associated with technological developments. Things like huge demographic shifts, you know, population explosion as a result of better medicine, better available water supply, you know, the idea of like how our global economy has become integrated as a result of better transport infrastructure, ships, cargo, things like that. And I think that if you were to just trace one of those, you would miss the bigger picture, which is that over a couple of hundred years, we have entered this world where there's billions and billions and billions of people on the planet. You know, you kind of roll back sort of 400, 500 years, and, you know, the numbers that people are talking about is sort of equivalent to sort of town councils, towns and things like that. So the idea I pursue when I'm talking about war and technology is to try and keep these two things in mind, is that there's a long-term kind of like development of technology, but also there's this constant search for military advantage. That is, with any kind of like new technology, leading states are always looking for, is this going to perhaps be used against us somehow? How could we perhaps develop something that could take advantage of it, that could give us a military edge? And it's not just states. Non-state actors do this. Non-state actors are very good at technological innovation, in part because they have to be. They generally have less resources than the states that seek to wipe them out or oppress them. this is why when we're looking at kind of new technologies in sort of like contemporary warfare, I think it's really important to keep non-state actors in mind, in part because sometimes they sort of show the way, because they are looking for perhaps the most efficient way of doing, the cheapest way of doing something. Sometimes they spring upon ideas like the use of drones and stuff like that, or mobile phones, cellular communications, that really close the gap between them and states.
Because there was a time in the early 90s following the Gulf War when there was a prevalent idea in the States called the revolution in military affairs, which seemed to suggest or seemed to believe that the US had such technological superiority in the military domain that really it was on a roll and it couldn't really be, it was sort of beyond challenge because the nature of technology in the military had fundamentally changed the game. And what you're saying is actually that's not the case, because there are ways for terrorist groups or insurgent groups to use technology in a different way, which doesn't have the vast budgets of the US military, but nonetheless can be deadly and effective.
The thing to keep in mind about the US military in the 1990s was that it was, like, it did have technology that was leaps ahead of its competitors, in part because the Soviet Union collapsed. But the kind of development of those technologies, they took decades to mature into what we saw used in, say, the 1990-1991 Gulf War. And they did have this idea that, you know, they could keep that kind of technological edge to keep them ahead of other states. But also, given the kind of conflicts that were going on in the 1990s, they did recognize the need to perhaps adjust what they're doing to try and counter sort of like non-state threats. I think what's very interesting is the US did manage to adapt this technology to counter non-state threats, particularly in sort of like the 2000s, Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, when you think about what, say, a Predator or a Reaper drone is, the use of Hellfire missiles, which were initially like anti-tank weapons, compared to sort of like a F-22 or F-35, like, you know, these drones are very, very simple. But the idea of kind of like these, which were once high-end remote piloted vehicles using sort of like anti-tank weapons strapped onto them, being used to sort of hunt insurgents, things like that, that shows how the military was kind of thinking about its need to adapt to these situations. At the same time, the kind of technology you need to develop to fight another state is not necessarily the technology that's going to work against some like a non-state actor. And I think this is kind of like the tension in all the technologies sort of developed for counterinsurgency, that some of them are not as useful for high-end warfighting. And I think the Russo-Ukraine war has kind of seen that. It's like, if you're used to an environment where there's no one firing at your artillery systems because they don't have artillery systems, and you have kind of complete air dominance, and you are able to like fly drones around to watch whatever you want to watch without them getting shot down, then fighting a peer opponent that's able to do all those things will come as a rude surprise. So I think like one of the very interesting things about technology in sort of like the 21st century is how not only non-state actors, but also how perhaps middle power states are able to develop technologies that give them kind of basic capabilities that are once very much beyond them. For example, you look at like the Turkish drone industry, Bayraktars and things like that. What was once the sort of preserve of the United States, select number of other states, is now becoming generally available. The idea of precision strike capabilities, which was kind of the center of revolution in military affairs, you know, send stuff, destroy it, like with one hit, one kill kind of thing, that's now proliferating. The idea that sort of non-state actors can use drones at a long distance to essentially have a basic cruise missile, which was once a restricted to state capabilities, almost like the gap between, not just between like middle powers and leading powers is perhaps closing, but also between states and non-state actors themselves. That's going to make things challenging for states in the 21st century, because trying to, say, maintain their edge over peer competitors or between like smaller competitors is going to be very expensive.
And it struck me when you were speaking, another domain where all that is true is in cyber warfare, isn't it? Where you don't have to be a power of the same size as the United States to cause significant damage. You don't even have to be a state. You could be a very small group with some cyber capability, and you could inflict significant harm. How do you see that sort of playing into the bigger picture of 21st century warfare?
One of the big things about cybersecurity and cyber warfare is just the fundamental vulnerability of everyone to intrusion. That is like the computer systems we use, the computer networks we use. It's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to create something that cannot be accessed by hostile actors. At the same time, developing the capability to access or disrupt somebody else's systems repeatedly over time, that's an institutional or organizational issue. And yes, non-state actors, hacking groups, crime gangs, things like that can do a lot of damage. But in terms of actual kind of cyber quotes capabilities, one of the things I think you see is like the states are able to have lots and lots of very small computer specialists working on these areas. They're also like more or less maps kind of who is already a major military power: United States, China, Russia. Where it gets, I think, particularly interesting is the line between state and non-state actor. Because one of the kind of key issues we have with cybersecurity and cyber warfare is anything that sort of like transits corporate networks or third-party communication systems. Obviously, there's people like Microsoft or Google or Facebook, if we're talking about like information warfare and Twitter and things like that, who all have an interest in sort of defending their kind of systems, products, platforms from intrusion and manipulation by state actors or criminal gangs. Also, the degree to which some states are willing to work with, say, criminal networks or tolerate criminal networks, kind of foster an ecosystem of computer specialists that are very good accessing or disrupting computer networks. That's kind of like blends into some of the debates people are having about private military and security companies, and this line between kind of like what sort of things should be reserved for states to do, and was it okay for states to say contract out third parties. I think like offensive cyber operations is one of those things where people, I think a lot of people really want just states to be doing this.
The very last thing I wanted to ask you, Jack, is not about expensive missile systems or even sophisticated hacking, but it is a profound technological change. It's the fact that very many people who are involved in conflicts or caught up in conflicts now have a smartphone in their pockets. What kind of impact, and I know this is another big question, and the impacts will be various depending on the conflict, but what kinds of impacts do you think the smartphone is having on war? And do you think they're really profound?
I think it has a huge impact in terms of how civilians participate or relate to war. If you go back to the initial conflicts after 9/11, things like Afghanistan, Iraq, 2003, we had very low rates of internet use, let alone like smartphones were coming in the distance. And one of the things that's perhaps interesting to consider is that some of the military operations that you saw back then would not really be possible, or at least would be like a lot more risky in the present day. If you look at Ukraine, the ability of, say, the Ukrainian government to collect information from its population in a systemized or standardized way to allow it to, say, track Russian troop movements, the fact that sort of like, I think there are some open source intelligence researchers who are looking at traffic congestion on like online mapping services in the immediate run up to the war, saying like, oh, there's these things. Essentially, states now have to fight in a goldfish bowl. Everything they do can be put online if there's somebody nearby with a smartphone. I don't think we're close to understanding the ramifications of this. We can see lots of effects going on. We can see the development of, say, like platforms for civilians to provide information that can be used as essentially, if not direct targeting data, can allow states to allocate military resources in the conflict very easily. Equally, you can see states reacting, you know, like Russian troops kind of like searching people's smartphones, seeing if they have apps, like assuming people are helping the Ukrainian government if they have a certain app, and punishing them, you know, harming them as a result. But I think what's interesting about these kind of conflicts is that we can't necessarily chart like how different societies might react or what kind of like social practices they may develop. One of the things about the Russo-Ukrainian war is we see a lot of footage coming out, particularly of Russians. We see a lot less footage coming out of Ukrainians. So we have to understand that like that our view of these conflicts, even though they seem like this unfiltered stream of imagery, they're still being shaped, but perhaps not by traditional mediators like, you know, mass media organizations and things like that. Where I think things are going to go is that I think there's going to be big questions about civilian neutrality, which is that if you understand sort of civilian protection is almost like a contract between combatants and civilians, which is that, you know, civilians can do certain stuff which might contribute to war effort and not make themselves liable to harm. But if you are effectively telling my opponent where my tank is located at this very moment, that's different from, say, paying taxes to support the war effort or like working in a munitions factory, something like that. What we see in Ukraine is, you know, pretty much a complete breakdown of that, at least in kind of when we're thinking about this specific smartphone use, which is that if civilians think it's fine to just report on where the Russians are at any given point in time, you know, like I'm not saying this is right or wrong here, I'm just saying like this is the issue, then where does that leave their opposing forces if every single civilian is effectively a sensor in a network designed to identify you and kill you? I think that it will become a lot more contentious in future wars where there isn't perhaps this kind of clear case of war of aggression and national defense, how civilians become part of a conflict by helping to provide that kind of information. And that, I think, is like the major sort of challenge going forwards.
That was Jack MacDonald, whose book, What is War For?, is available now. There are more details about it and the other titles in the series on the Bristol University Press website, bristoluniversitypress.co.uk. Thanks for listening to this short series of conversations about the launch titles in the What Is It For series. There are plenty more titles coming over the next few years. Up next, the Olympics, animal rights, prisons and history. But for now, from me, goodbye.